Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Why is it the U.S. no longer has the capacity to win wars? Western publics are universally against war, but their elites are not. Who is behind these elites? And are forever wars now the norm and not the exception? Cross-talking with me is Denis Kucinich in Washington. He is a former congressman of 16 years, a mayor, and a former Democratic presidential candidate. Welcome to the program, Denis. It's a delight to have you. I'm calling this program Evolution or Breakdown. You and I are in the same age cohort, roughly, and we've seen a lot of changes. Is this an evolution or is it a breakdown when it comes to American foreign policy? And I don't think we need to specifically talk about individuals, though that may be important. But we've seen quite a bit of change over the last few decades. And I think we both would agree, not for the good. Go ahead.
Well, we've moved from a unipolar system where America's military might had a major influence on international decisions and on the direction of the world. Today, it's different. We have a multipolar world. And there are people in Washington who fail to understand that no one nation has the ability or even the authority to be able to dictate to other nations what their policy should be. We're looking at the necessity of cooperation. There needs to be an understanding that the world is interconnected, it's interdependent. What happens in one place in the world affects all of us. And so that kind of thinking is slow to catch on in certain circles in Washington.
Yeah, well, it seems like there's an enormous amount of resistance to it as well. As I said in my introduction, American voters and Western citizens in general have uniformly made it clear, at least through public opinion polls, that they don't want war. They're against war. If we look at probably the last four or five presidential cycles, an anti-war message resonated, but it never makes it into the White House. Why is that?
Well, I ran for president challenging wars in 2004 and 2008. And I've seen the genesis of wars during my time in the United States Congress, generally based on lies. Now, why are we... Why is the United States continually embroiled in wars? War's a business. War's a racket. War enables people to make extraordinary amounts of money. Sure. And, I mean, that's really, it's about greed. I wish I could become, you know, I wish I could give you an explanation that would gain respect because it seems more complex. But it's pretty simple. War's a business. You know, today, America is prepared to spend 80% of its domestic spending on war, 80%. And when you look at it, we have not been able to address housing needs, healthcare, education, job creation, all those things. We prefer, our leaders prefer war than to taking care of our own people.
Well, and also we have special interest groups. I mean, you've already, we can mention the arms manufacturers, and then there's like the Israeli lobby that has a very strong influence. They seem to be what we would call in the social sciences elite capture. They are captured by these special interest groups. And it's becoming extremely obvious when the public is asked about these things. The Iran war is the most unpopular war in American history, and that was before it even started.
Well, as well it should be. There's no reason why the United States security interests are affected by Iran. But Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, has made it clear that his objective is to capsize the government of Iran and to be able to influence Iranian policy using the United States military force as his own personal club. That's unacceptable. We need to stand apart as a nation and be free of foreign influences and free of the influence of Israel. And Netanyahu's ultra-Zionist wing in Likud which is leading Israel to disaster and could lead the world into a much wider war.
You know, one of the interesting things that has happened over the last few years, and I'm going to use as an inflection point the genocide in Gaza, the impact on American soft power is almost difficult to measure. Because if you live inside the United States and you're affected by the media bubble, which Americans certainly are, they have no idea how little respect the United States has in the world because of that. And now we have this war in Iran that was unprovoked, a war of choice, and it really diminishes the standing of the United States in the world. Donald Trump came to power saying he would end the conflict in Ukraine in one day. Well, that didn't come to pass, but he still could do it. But he doesn't. And that's America's standing when it comes to the issue of war and peace is rating pretty low globally. Go ahead.
Well, and that's very sad. But let's look at where we are. The U.S. was led into a war against Iraq based on lies. Benjamin Netanyahu sat across from me in a committee meeting, and he was appearing there in September of 2002. To urge the United States to attack Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11, with al-Qaeda's role in 9/11. Iraq didn't have the intention or capability of attacking the United States. But Netanyahu was the principal cheerleader for the war. We went to war against Iraq, cost $5 trillion, put most of it on the credit card, killed about 1 million innocent Iraqis, and 5,000 of our brave men and women perished in that war. So if you look at where America's headed. We're not using soft power anymore because there is people have confused diplomacy with military strength. And you might have military strength standing behind you, but the art of diplomacy is the art of human relations. It's the art of respect. It's an understanding of the inner equality of all people. And you can't put a gun on the table and call that diplomacy. Well, and the United States, unfortunately, has been doing that.
And diplomacy is good is because you get what you want without going to war. Isn't that a better formulation?
100%, Peter. That's the whole idea of diplomacy. And so, you know, we've lost that capacity. If you look at what's happening in Iran, we went to war at the behest of Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. The Jerusalem Post recently published an editorial suggesting that young Americans ought to go and fight for Israel, and if they do, they should be able to get debt forgiveness. This is horrific. And the influence that Israeli interests have on the U.S. government right now for those Americans who are participating in that, in making official decisions on behalf of Israel, that's not in the interests of the United States. And it borders on a kind of treason. I choose that word very carefully. I think that America needs to change its role in the world. We need to understand that we are a nation among nations, not a nation above nations, that we are a nation that has the potential to help the world community move towards peace, but we're doing the opposite. We're moving towards war. And I might add, Peter, this situation in Iran has the potential to absolutely spin out of control towards a nuclear confrontation.
Absolutely. And we could see that also in Europe. I mean, what I find really perplexing, because it's so obvious, is that affordability is the issue for almost the majority of voters. Is you know, you can throw in the culture wars and all you want, and which I find to be very tedious and not getting us anywhere. But affordability is an issue here. These foreign policies are putting more strain on people that are under a lot of strain already.
Well, you're right about that, Peter. Let me get more specific on that. What are the practical aspirations of people, not just in the United States, but in Russia, and I would say worldwide? It's to be able to have a roof over your head and your family. It's to be able to put food on the table. It's to make sure the health of those near and dear to you is protected. Make sure your children are educated. Those are practical aspirations. People have those aspirations everywhere. War is antithetical to being able to fulfill the concerns and the desires and the dreams of people everywhere. And war is a racket. I mentioned it earlier. We need to understand that we must put an end to war before war puts an end to us.
And we see voters coming out and saying that exactly, looking at all of these primaries. Again, I'm not going to pick on one political party at this point, but I mean, if it's a Democrat or a Republican, now the issue of war and peace is finally, and you and I know that American voters don't usually go to the polls and vote on foreign policy, but that is a breakthrough in this season.
In some cases, not in all.
Some cases.
You know, right, you're right to point out that this is not a partisan matter. Look, in 2014, it was the Democrats who overthrew the government of Ukraine. They knocked out Viktor Yanukovych, put somebody in who was the U.S.'s guy, Yats, and the next thing that happened was they got the government of Ukraine to attack the Donbass, and we ended up in Russia having to come in to protect the Russian-speaking people, over 10,000 of whom had been murdered by the new Ukrainian government. So the U.S. precipitated that, and the U.S. is needed to put an end to this war in Ukraine, and the way to do it is to tell Europe to stop providing more arms to attack Russia, and then, you know, to move away from this dialectic of conflict. And it's very clear what's happened here. And NATO and Europe right now have some kind of fantasy that they are, this is finally the opportunity to defeat Russia. That is not going to happen.
Dennis, I would go further. I would call it a death wish. That's what they have, is a death wish, because the more they push this war, the more they damage themselves, which is almost inexplicable. It certainly doesn't make good political sense. Dennis, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on American foreign policy. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Remind you, we're discussing American foreign policy. Okay, Dennis, you're no stranger to Democratic politics, Democratic Party politics. Can you explain to me and our viewers why the Democratic Party, at least its base overwhelmingly, has turned against Israel and Israel's machinations in creating a greater Israel in the Middle East with the support of the United States? But there are almost many of them are fanatical Ukraine war advocates. How do you explain that?
Well, let's separate the two immediately. First of all, the Democratic Party officially has in Washington has not separated itself from Israel. Democrats voting across the country are showing their displeasure with candidates who are locked into Israeli policies. Now, and so there is a sea change coming in the relationship between U.S. voters, particularly Democrats, and candidates who are seem more loyal to Israel than they are to the United States. So that's, you know, there's more happening there. Now let's talk about the attitudes about Ukraine. You have to go back to 2014 when the Democratic Party was really supporting Hillary Clinton's foreign policy, attacking. Not engaging Russia constructively, but the idea is you can, you know, bloody the nose of the Russian bear by putting a U.S. flag closer to the Donbass, and of course that was a disaster for the Ukrainian people as well as for the Russian people, but the Democrats got tied into this anti-Russian theme starting in 2014, but then you go to the 2016 presidential election where Hillary Clinton was on her way to becoming president. And what happened was James Comey, on the eve of the election, raised questions about possible illegal behavior on her behalf that caused her to lose several states that she was counting on winning. Trump wins the election. Clinton, unable to accept the results of the election, blames Russia.
Yep.
And that meme went on and on and on. Of course, it was totally false, but it didn't matter. It stuck. You know, it's like the runs halfway around the world before the truth gets up and gets its ants on. And so That's the overhang in Democratic views with respect to Russia. And it's stupid. It's counterproductive. We should be working with Russia as a major power to look at how we can create peace in the world and, hello, prosperity, which, frankly, goes along with peace for everyone, not the interest groups, of course, who support war.
Yeah, Dennis, unfortunately, Russiagate will probably never die either because it still rears its ugly head from time to time. One of the problems that American foreign policy, at least for the mere mortals, has to experience is that, you know, you mentioned 2016 in the presidential election of that year and Hillary Clinton's candidacy. We saw an enormous number of disaffected Republicans who did not like Donald Trump, and many of them were notable neocons, and they moved to the Democratic Party, and they never left. So what we have is we have two major parties that are infiltrated by neocons, which they should both be expunged from for their road record at the very least since the end of the Cold War. But they're like a cold that won't go away.
Well, it's very interesting you said that because those who have been for wars, promoted wars, and who have been 100% wrong, who accepted the lies and that cost the American people trillions upon trillions of dollars, drove our national debt, deprived our own people of a better quality of life, cost 5,000 soldiers in Iraq to die. The ones who promoted that, many of them themselves got promotions.
Yep.
In other words, if you're for war, you get kicked upstairs.
Yep.
But if you're for peace, they don't want to hear about that. So I'm proud of having taken a stand. It's not just about being right. It's about doing the right thing for the people you represent. And the people I represented in the United States Congress, they didn't want war. They wanted job opportunities, better wages, health care, education, retirement security, safe neighborhoods. These are all aspirations, as I mentioned earlier, Peter, that people everywhere have. But in the United States, we're being denied of a decent quality of living because of the addiction which our leaders have to war. And truth doesn't matter anymore here. It's a form of a cancerous realpolitik, which puts us in a direction where now our economy is going to tank. You know, these wars, in terms of Iraq, we've shut down the Strait of Hormuz. The administration keeps telling fantastic stories about oil being moved through the Strait of Hormuz. We've shut it down by attacking Iran. We killed Iran's leader. We killed 168 people, mostly children, at Manab. That was horrific. It cries out for justice, and yet the United States government blithely just continues on with this fantasy that we're going to conquer Iran. That is not going to happen, and what we need to do is to end that war, to come to terms with Iran, to understand that we're not in a unipolar world. We're not going to dictate Israel's agenda to Iran. That simply is not going to happen.
You know, Dennis, one of the things is that, you know, I would put you in the category, we're both in the category of what I would call a restrainer, okay? Accept the multipolar world, look for cooperation instead of conflict. That's a win-win process. But, you know, we're both born and brought up in the United States, and that's not part of the ethos that we are taught from a very young age, is that America is exceptional. But if America is exceptional, then everyone else is expendable. That's the problem, and people don't understand it. That's a long introduction to saying, unfortunately, in my mind, it will have to take a major defeat and maybe an economic crash for a reordering of American foreign policy priorities, because people can yell from the hilltop that we don't want war, we don't want war, and it doesn't translate into policy. Is that something that you worry about? Because in our short conversation here, we've seen bits and pieces of that coming together where, you know, there's going to be some kind of a crisis of global proportions.
Well, we're on the threshold of that crisis, Peter, and I'll be specific. The United States has no way of using its Navy to
Did you see the video of the USS Lincoln going to port?
I'm aware of that. And what I'm saying that our Navy, our Air Force, and our Army are not in a position to be able to conquer Iran. But one thing, and because of the lack of success that has occurred, we have to worry about people in Washington right now who are pushing this idea of using tactical nuclear weapons. Now, the United States has used nuclear weapons before against Japan in 1945. It wasn't necessary to use them, and history has shown that it was the wrong decision. However, a use of any kind of nuclear weapons against Iran would unleash the nuclear genie and could bring in other nations into the conflict very quickly, as well as forever cause the United States to be held in contempt worldwide. I think this, again, you have to go back to the understanding of the necessity of diplomacy, of respect, of mutual cooperation instead of mutual assured destruction. And one thing that's happening is the American economy is already in trouble. The dollar has been sinking in value. The petrodollar is on the wane. We're seeing trade going on in yuan and other currencies for oil. So I think America has to wake up and understand that our leaders are taking us in a position which will lead to the destruction of our own nation. You know, this idea, if you have an enemy and you want to kill them, you better dig two graves, one for your enemy and one for yourself.
You know, Denny, you've mentioned something I think is really, really important, is that I would say you and I are children of the Cold War, and we learned, and quite rightly, to be afraid of nuclear war. That ethos doesn't exist anymore. We know that the current administration is casually talking about the use of these weapons. In our time, that was unthinkable. That's what the very definition of what was unthinkable. How do we get back to that?
Well, what we don't want to do is to go back to the days of what in the United States we'd call duck and cover drills.
Yep.
Where children would hide under their school desk, close their eyes so they wouldn't see the flash, and somehow that was going to protect them from annihilation if a nuclear weapon was dropped. The U.S. and Russia were at loggerheads with the possibility of a nuclear war in the 50s and 60s, but let's look at where we are today. We need to get rid of nuclear weapons. And the U.S. should lead the way in doing that. There shouldn't even be talk about using nuclear weapons. We have to understand it is suicidal. And we grew up in an era where the Cold War, let's face it, the people, the elites on both sides made a lot of money during the Cold War, selling this idea that we're going to kill each other. Let me tell you a quick story. The first time I visited Russia, as the plane broke through the clouds on the way to Sheremetyevo Airport, I looked at these dachas in the countryside. It looked like Pennsylvania in the 19th century in the U.S. And the humanity and the humility of the Russian people struck me instantly. I actually started to cry because we almost annihilated each other. We have to remember the basic humanity that connects us and stop this idea that we can that we are going to be able to conquer each other. The only real conquest is the conquest of any evil that may exist in the human heart. That's what we have to look at. And this idea that one nation is going to conquer another, that is so yesterday. You talked about evolution at the beginning of this, Peter. We have to evolve to a condition where we're more than we are, where we're better than we are, where we beat our swords into plowshares and our spears into pruning hooks. That's a possibility. It's not a fantasy notion, and we need to work towards that.
I would say it's a necessity at this point. We have to go in that direction. There was a great philosopher who said, the Russians love their children, too. On that note, thank you very much, Dennis. It's been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank you in Washington, and of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.